Britain's chief initial interest in the French Revolution was a concern that it would spread to England. Such fears were reinforced by trouble at home. The seamen of Shields, more than 1,000 of them, had seized their owners' ships in an attempt to have their wages raised, and a couple of sloops had been sent to deal with them. Their enthusiasm for liberty, as Collingwood put it, raging even to madness. He was overstating the case, certainly, but with the worst of the Parisian terrors making the news almost weekly, it's easy to see how the British establishment was nervous. But Britain had ulterior motives, too. First was a wish to punish the French for their intervention in the American War of Independence. It rankled with the government, and it rankled with the Navy. Second, under the guise of declaring war on a country for assassinating its king, an instance, if ever there was one, of the pot calling the kettle black, British trading interests saw the advantages of using the war to take possession of key French islands in the Caribbean, while the American government of George Washington declared a pragmatic, if ungrateful, neutrality. Although the period of the so-called Spanish armament meant that the British fleet was in good order, the declaration of war by France in February 1793 after the execution of King Louis XVI in January found the Navy suffering from undermanning, inexperience and favouritism. Collingwood had been made flag captain to an old friend, George Bowyer, who was now an admiral. They were offered Prince, a 98-gun first-rate ship of the line, vastly bigger, more unmanageable and more prestigious than anything he had had before. For the first time since Collingwood was a midshipman, Britain was waging war against a deadly and determined enemy, whose naval power was equal to hers. Though the Revolution had done terrible damage to the ranks of officers in the French fleet, her ships were universally regarded as superior in build and sailing qualities to those of the corrupt and conservative British yards. Whether her new Jacobin officers could sail and fight them was another matter. Britain divided her navy into two fleets, one to protect trade in the Atlantic and prevent invasion from France, the other to wage war in the Mediterranean, by seizing key strategic possessions and reinforcing, or just forcing, relations with wavering allies. Collingwood, stationed in Atlantic and home waters under the ageing Lord Howe, would soon be fighting in his first major fleet action. He'd been at sea on and off for 30 years, was a highly experienced, thoroughly professional seaman and commander. He'd developed a way of dealing with men that was stern and reserved, but just and humane. He loathed flogging, and although he also despised mutiny and insubordination, he would rightly blame a bad crew on poor and weak officers. A story related by Collingwood's first biographer, also his son-in-law, recounts how a midshipman had once reported an old and experienced sailor for some misdemeanour. Collingwood wrote to him, "In all probability the fault was yours, but whether it were or not, I am sure it would go to your heart to see a man old enough to be your father disgraced and punished on your account, and it will, therefore, give me a good opinion of your disposition if, when he is brought out, you ask for his pardon." When, after receiving this letter, the midshipman duly begged the man off his punishment, Collingwood apparently said to the sailor, though with a show of pained reluctance, "This young gentleman has pleaded so humanely for you that in the hope that you will feel a due gratitude to him for his benevolence, I will for this time overlook your offence." No wonder it was later said by one of his junior officers that a look of displeasure from him was worse than 12 lashes at the gangway from another captain. These were the qualities of leadership that he possessed, and now they would be put to the test. The winter of 1793-4 had been spent on an unsuccessful cruise, which resulted in Lord Howe being criticised for failing to find and defeat the French fleet. The home press made the fleet's return uncomfortable, for to be unfortunate in war was seen as a failure almost as serious as defeat. At least the cruise had given its commanders time to get their crews into some sort of shape. But Collingwood and Bowyer now had to transfer into Barfleur, another first rate, and work up a new crew to their ways. In the meantime, the French were harrying Atlantic convoys, but Howe's fleet missed the French time and again. Collingwood, as depressed by the general situation as any other officer, looked to letters and news from the north for his comfort. Bounce's experiences of this time are sadly unrecorded. Howe's duties in the Atlantic, apart from hoping the French fleet would fall into his lap, included the escort of British merchant convoys to America and the interception of convoys trading between America and France. Intelligence brought him news in spring 1794 that a convoy of 117 ships was on its way to France, and that the French fleet would be sent out to meet it. While withdrawing his frigates from Brest to allow the French to get out, Howe cruised the shipping lanes of the North Atlantic, hoping to sight and trail the convoy. When the French fleet was finally sighted, it lay between the British ships and the convoy. During 3 days of skirmishes, Howe manoeuvred his fleet into a position of strategic advantage. A fleet action was quite unlike anything that a frigate was likely to encounter. For one thing, line-of-battle ships were vastly bigger, a crew of 800 or so men and officers, up to 50 guns on either side and a broadside weight of over 1,000 pounds, 10 times the firepower of a 28-gun frigate. Sails, masts, rigging were more complicated and heavier to handle, and the ship harder to manoeuvre. There were 3 gun decks to manage, and it was paramount for discipline to be tight. At battle stations, marines would be posted on every gangway to ensure that no sailor could flee his station in a moment of panic. Conditions below deck were naturally more crowded, and in battle the confusion caused by smoke, dismounted guns, people running here and there, injuries and debris can only be imagined. Precision and practice in the art of gunnery was vital to gain an advantage over an enemy that might be superior in numbers. Nelson, Collingwood, and many other captains of their generation had honed a theory and practice of gunnery excellence that, above all other considerations, would ensure a series of stunning victories over Spain and France over the next 20 years. This was to be the largest fleet action for nearly 2 generations, 25 ships of the line against 25. On June 1st, the battle began in earnest, each British ship choosing a French counterpart to attack in the line of battle. "Then down we went," wrote Collingwood to his father-in-law, "under a crowd of sail, and in a manner that would have animated the coldest heart and struck terror into the most intrepid enemy. The ship we were to engage was 2 ahead of the French admiral, so that we had to go through his fire and that of the 2 ships next to him, and received all their broadsides 2 or 3 times before we fired a gun. I observed to the admiral that about that time our wives were going to church, but that I thought the peal we should ring about the Frenchmen's ears would outdo their parish bells. We got very near indeed, and then began such a fire as would have done you good to have heard." Collingwood from that moment literally had his arms full, for he caught his wounded admiral, though he had lost a leg, as he fell, thinking he might end up being the only officer left on deck, so fierce was the fighting. 1 French ship sank, and 6 others were taken or destroyed, while several of the British fleet suffered severe damage. The precious convoy had got through, so in a sense the victory was incomplete. But it was what the British public had been waiting for, and the King proclaimed it the glorious 1st of June. Collingwood might be satisfied that for the second time he had behaved with courage and coolness in battle, despite the disappointment of not receiving a glorious wound. But injury he did suffer, of another sort, and it would pain him for years afterwards. It was a wound to his professional pride and to his honour. No man's conduct on that day, it was agreed by all who'd taken part, stood out. All had been brave, intelligent, and equally deserving of the glory. But after the official dispatch was written to inform the Admiralty of the victory, a second letter, drafted by Sir Roger Curtis and carelessly approved by Howe, was sent in which some of the captains were singled out for praise. By implication, the others were not so deserving, and Collingwood was one of them. He wrote, "The appearance of that letter had nearly broke my heart. I told Sir Roger that I considered the conduct of the Barfleur had merited commendation, when commendation was given to zeal and activity, and that an insinuation that either had been wanting was injurious and unjust. Lord Howe is less blamed for his letter than his captain, who has ever been an artful, sneaking creature, whose fawning, insinuating manners creeps into the confidence of whoever he attacks. The letter may be considered as a libel on the fleet." While those mentioned in the dispatch received specially struck medals from the King, Collingwood did not. Even those who had medals felt ashamed to receive them in the furore which followed. However, Collingwood, in the eyes of those who counted, his fellow captains, Curtis aside, had distinguished himself in his first fleet action. The episode shows a marked characteristic in him, that while he took a singular lack of interest in public fame, unlike his best friend, he was very jealous indeed of his professional reputation. From now on, he was determined to bring the French to action again in order to wipe the perceived slur from his name. Collingwood could hardly wait for another chance to get at them and erase what he thought of as the stain on his record. In the late summer of 1794, he had a chance to go home for a little while, but spent just 2 days in Northumberland before having to go back to Portsmouth. His new ship, Hector, of 74 guns, had been given to him by Lord Chatham, the First Lord of the Admiralty, who was an admirer of his. But it proved impossible to find enough men to give her a full complement. So after another brief trip home, Collingwood took command of Excellent, also a 74, and at the beginning of 1795 shepherded a convoy of merchant vessels into the Mediterranean, where he had not sailed for nearly 25 years. Nelson, already stationed there and charged with strangling French trade, was delighted.